All right, so this is Bio 160, and it's Tuesday, October 21st, and we're going to start the special census chapter today after we answer some questions on the nervous system. We'll go over the review guide, the student study guide, or if you have questions, that's fine. All right, I guess the first thing that I want you to do is to look at your quiz that you're going to turn in today. Make sure your name is on there, because I have a quiz that you turned in from last time with no name on it, and I don't know who to give credit to for that one. So make sure your name is on there, and then pass it over to your right, and then the people in that side of the room, just pass it down, and I'll collect them down on this side of the room. Make sure your name is on there before you give it away to anybody. Okay? Please. Must write name on quiz. Oh, you got it. Okay. Great. All right. I also put on the wall over here all your grades, your quiz scores, your test scores, and your overall average in the class to date. And then if I had to give a grade today, what it would be. And then the next four columns show you what you have to get as a percentage on everything else in the class to get an A, B, C, or D in the class. All right, now don't forget that you only have to take 12 quizzes, so you get to drop two. And in this calculation right here, it doesn't calculate which two you're going to drop, so if you missed a quiz right now, it counts as a zero, but when you take all 14 quizzes, that zero will go away and you'll probably see a big bump up in your grade. So this is just an approximation of where you stand in the class. Don't forget, your two lowest quizzes will disappear. All right, now I can't publish your scores by your student number or by your name, because that's illegal to do that. So I just ranked everybody by their first two tests. So the person that got the highest score on the first test is in the first position over here, and then on down the line, but if there are two people that got the same score on the first test, then the second column, I rank them by what their score is on the second test. So this is by ranking on your tests. But if you don't know what you got on your tests, I have a score sheet that has your name on it, and so after class, I can show you exactly where you are in the class. All right, on Blackboard, I tried to have Blackboard calculate your percentage in the class, but it makes no sense whatsoever, and I don't know what's wrong with the program. So if you want to find out your overall average, this is what you have to look at. Because, for instance, there's somebody that got 100% on everything, but they missed a quiz, and they're down in the 80s. And then somebody else has some 80%. And their average on Blackboard is 97, so it doesn't make any sense. So I'll try to figure that out. I'll let you know if that works. Okay. So your scores, your individual scores in Blackboard are correct, but the calculations are incorrect. This is the correct one that's on the board right here. All right, so are there any other quizzes that anybody else wants to turn in? And we have a name? Right on. Okay. Good. All right, so next time we're going to have a test on, what is that test going to be on? Special senses, nervous system, and muscle. Okay, so you need a Scantron and a good eraser for that. So let's look at some of the questions that maybe you worked on over the weekend on nervous system. Okay, and then we'll talk about the special senses. All right, so number one, what are the two most general divisions of the nervous system? Peripheral nervous system and central. Probably, I would say central nervous system and peripheral, but it doesn't matter what order you say it in. Okay. What are the two divisions of the central nervous system? Yep, and there's structural divisions, so the brain and the spinal cord. All right, so the brain is in the cranial cavity, the spinal cord is in the vertebral cavity. If you want to look back to chapter number one. What are the two divisions of the peripheral nervous system? So you know where I would be looking in my notes? That very first page that has, you know, how everything is divided up. Okay, so let's get back to question number two. What are the two divisions of the peripheral nervous system? You've got sensory and motor. What two categories are the motor division classified into? Somatic and autonomic. What does somatic mean? It means voluntary. That means what you have voluntary control over. You can excite those tissues or not excite those tissues, depending on your conscious thought. And what is that one tissue that you can control in your body? And it's the only thing. Of everything that's going inside your body, you can only control one thing. It's very disappointing, personally, to me, but I've lived long enough, so I guess it's okay. It's what? Skeletal muscle. Skeletal muscle is the only thing you have conscious control over. Everything else gets taken care of automatically. All right. What are the two divisions of the autonomic nervous system? The parasympathetic and the sympathetic. Right? Sympathetic and parasympathetic. Name two types of cells which make up the nervous system or nervous tissue. There are the kinds that transmit electrical impulses. Those are neurons. And then there are the support cells, which we call neuroglia. Name the type of cell which is specialized for the transmission of nerve impulses. Oh, we just said that. That's a neuron. That's a neuron, right. Okay, name the parts of a neuron. Let's start with the receiving end going to the sending end. The receiving end is a dendrite. And then what's the next part? Cell body. What's another name for cell body? The soma, S-O-M-A. All right, and then what's another part? Axon. And then probably you might want to make the axon terminus another part, the tip of an axon, because it helps make a chemical synapse. Number five, what is the name of the chemical that a Schwann cell synthesizes? Myelin. Myelin. Okay. And that, don't forget, that's an insulating material, and it allows the nerve impulse to hop down an axon instead of being transmitted continuously. And when a nerve impulse hops down, we call that saltatory conduction. I don't know if you have to know that or not, but anyway, I'll just mention it right now. You know what? I left something out on question number four. In what direction is a nerve impulse always transmitted? Dendrite to axon, but you might want to say dendrite to cell body to axon, just down the line, just like that. Okay. All right, definitions. What is gray matter? Gray matter. It's going to be nervous tissue. It's going to be something that's not myelinated, because if it's myelinated, it's going to be white. So things that are not myelinated are dendrites and cell bodies. So it's a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites someplace. And white matter is going to be something that is myelinated, because myelin looks white, and the only things that are myelinated are axons. So white matter are myelinated axons. All right, what about a nucleus? Oh, here we use that word for a number of different things. But in terms of the nervous system, where would you find a nucleus? Okay, central nervous system, and I like deep in the central nervous system someplace. And what the heck is it? What color is it? Okay, well, what are the two colors? Either gray or white, and a nucleus is a bunch of nerve cell bodies. It's an accumulation of nerve cell bodies someplace deep inside the central nervous system. So it's gray matter. It's a gray matter deep inside the nervous system. And in particular, the central nervous system. So nucleus is inside the central nervous system. What about a ganglia or a ganglion? Yeah, so it's very similar to a nucleus, right? A nucleus, though, is in the central nervous system. A ganglion is the exact same thing, but it's in the peripheral nervous system. Two different locations. All right, and a nerve. What the heck is a nerve? Yeah, it's an organ. It's myelinated axons that are all going someplace in your peripheral nervous system. Right, so someplace in your periphery, like your arm or your leg or your trunk, it's a group of myelinated axons going someplace, and it has connective tissue around it. It even has blood vessels going into it to nourish those axons and those Schwann cells. And that's similar to a nerve tract, but where do you find a nerve tract? That's going to be in the central nervous system. So that's just white matter in the central nervous system someplace, and a nerve is white matter in the peripheral nervous system. So you have tracts. All right, what is a node of Ranvier? Yeah, it's those little spots between Schwann cells, and in that little spot, it's not myelinated, so currents can leak out of an axon, and that's what helps propagate a nerve impulse, those little spaces between the Schwann cells. And it's called a node of Ranvier. Okay. Here's a good question, number 8. What two ions are important for establishing a resting membrane potential? Or another word for potential is voltage, the resting cell voltage. What two ions are important? Sodium and potassium. Yeah, just say that. Sodium and potassium. Maybe you should know the abbreviation. What is the abbreviation for sodium? Na. Are you serious? It's not S? It's not S. That's right. It is Na because it stands for natrium, which is Greek for sodium. So you have to learn how to translate. Okay. Which ion, so you got sodium and potassium, which ion is at higher concentration outside the cell? It's a sodium one, which is what? Na. Na is high on the outside. Which ion is higher concentration inside the cell when it's at rest? It's potassium, right? Oh, what's the symbol for potassium? K. How do you spell that? K, right? Not Q-U-E. All right. Which ion is at higher concentration inside the cell? I thought we just asked that one. Okay. That might be a neurological sign of something. I'm not sure. Okay, number 10. What are the two events that make up an action potential? So an action potential is two events. What are the two events? Depolarization and repolarization. And I like the way you said it. You should always say one happens before the other. And depolarization always happens before repolarization. So just say depolarization, then repolarization, the two events. All right, know which ions make up the two events. So what are the two events again? The first one is depolarization. And what causes depolarization? Sodium. Which way does sodium go? Moves inside the cell. And repolarization is due to potassium leaving the cell, going the opposite way. So those are the two events. One is responsible for depolarization and the other is responsible for repolarization. Okay, so what is a synapse? What does it allow cells to do? Communicate with each other. So a synapse is a way that cells can communicate with each other or pass on stimulation or information. So what I put on the board is synapse is the structural and functional unit of communication between cells. So you should know all the little pieces of a synapse and how it functions. And if you know how one synapse works, you pretty much know how all synapses or how all cells in the body communicate. All right, so how is information transmitted within a neuron? What kind of signal is it? Within a neuron, it is an electrical signal. And how is it transmitted between neurons? Can it be an electrical signal? Can one neuron like shoot out a lightning bolt and stimulate another one? It would work, but that's too drastic. The signal is a chemical signal. So between neurons, it's a chemical signal that's transmitted. What do we call that chemical signal that's transmitted between cells? And it's coming from a neuron, so we call that a neurotransmitter. So that chemical signal that's transmitted between neurons is called a neurotransmitter. So that helps answer the next question. What is a neurotransmitter? That helps send information from one neuron to another. And I'll give me a good example of a neurotransmitter. Acetylcholine is a good example. That's also used at the neuromuscular junction. Norepinephrine is another one. Serotonin is one. Dopamine is another one. A methyl group in one part of the molecule. They both have similar kinds of functions. Epinephrine is released from the adrenal medulla and it produces sympathetic effects all over the body. Norepinephrine is usually used as the neurotransmitter, only at a synapse. So epinephrine and norepinephrine have similar kinds of effects, but epinephrine is considered more like a hormone and norepinephrine more like a neurotransmitter, but they both can act like either one. So it's just a little modification on one amino group. Have you had chemistry at all, ever? Not yet. Okay, well, a methyl group is just a CH3 that's been added to the molecule. Okay, so it's a simple modification, but that changes the shape of the molecule and how it works in the body. Okay. All right, number 12. What are the four areas of the brain stem? Brain stem, that's the lowest part of the brain. So what's the lowest part of the brain stem? That would be the medulla oblongata. And then right above that is the pons. And then right above that is the midbrain. And let's see, the fourth one. There's another one that's not really so structural. It's more of a functional area, and it includes everything that we said so far, especially the medulla and the pons. That's the reticular formation. Reticular formation. What's the function? That's part of the question there. Look at that. Oh, what's the function of the reticular formation? What does it do? It keeps you awake, right? It keeps you conscious in a wakeful state. And when it fatigues, when it poops out, what happens? You fall asleep, right? All right. Well, let's go all the way back down to the very bottom area, the medulla. What is it important for? Heart rate is real important, so the cardioregulatory center is there. And the respiratory center is in there. And the vasomotor center is in there. It helps regulate blood pressure. So there's a lot of things that it does. That's in your notes. And the pons. It's the way that information can get from the brainstem into the cerebellum. And the cerebellum is important because it makes you act coordinated when you're walking, okay? Gives you coordination so you don't fall and things like that. All right, so those are the areas of the brainstem. What are the two areas of the diencephalon? The thalamus and hypothalamus. Which one is on top of the other? The thalamus, and which one is underneath it? That's what hypo means. It just means underneath. All right, so give a function of each. So let's talk about the thalamus first. Yeah, it's a relay station for information come to the periphery as it's moving to the cerebral cortex. It has to stop in the thalamus, and the thalamus then tells it where to go on the surface of the brain. And then those nerves in the surface of the brain depolarize, and then you have a sensation of reality or a picture of reality or however you want to talk about that. That's the thalamus. It directs sensory signals to go to the proper part of the cerebral cortex. So that's another way of saying it acts like a relay station for signals. All right, and then the hypothalamus. It controls a number of things like appetite and thirst, and it also controls the pituitary gland. And the pituitary gland is a very important endocrine gland. So the hypothalamus controls your endocrine system as a result of that. Okay, so it controls what? Reproductive cycles. It controls your thyroid gland and your adrenal gland, another part of the adrenal gland. All right, what's the largest part of the human brain? The cerebrum, right? The cerebral hemispheres. What is a gyrus and a sulcus? A gyrus is, I tell you what, if you put them both together, what do you get? You get a fold. What's a fancy name for a fold? A fancy name for a fold is a convolution. Convolution. All right. And what are the two parts of a convolution? Yeah, you got the high part, which is the gyrus, and then you got the depression. That's the sulcus. That's the best way to think of that. Identify the four lobes of the cerebrum, or cerebral cortex. So, what are they? Should we do it in a reverse order? So from the back, from the posterior, you got occipital, parietal, frontal, and then temporal. Those are the four lobes. Now, what about the functions? Let's start in the front. The frontal lobe, important for? Motor. It initiates skeletal muscle movement. That's where those neurons, when they start to depolarize, that means you're making a conscious effort to move some part of your body. That's the frontal lobe. And how can you remember that? It's because it's in the front. Okay. What else is in the front? In some frontal bone is there. Yeah. But in your car, what's in the front? Yeah, the motor's in the front. So that's sort of what I remember most times, right? So frontal lobe is motor. Parietal lobe, what's that for? Sensory, on the surface of your body. We call that somatosensory cortex. Occipital lobe is important for vision. And the temporal lobe is important for hearing. Yeah, for auditory processing. Temporal is for auditory, sense of hearing. All right, be able to identify the cerebellum. How could you describe where the cerebellum is? Where is the cerebellum? It's part of your brain. Yeah, it's inferior to the occipital lobe, so it's posterior, and it's inferior to the occipital lobe. All right, and what is its function? Balance. It balances motor activity in your body. All right, so that you can do complicated things like walking. Walking is actually a very complicated kind of thing to do. Where is the spinal cord, and is it part of the central nervous system? Where does the spinal cord begin? Yep, begins at the foramen magnum. That's right in the occipital bone. And is it part of the central nervous system? Sure is. It's the second part of it. What are the two pathways entering or leaving the spinal cord called? Yeah, they're called roots. And there are two of them. There's one that's anterior. We call that the ventral root. And then there's one that's posterior. We call that the dorsal root. Because dorsal means posterior. Ventral means anterior. All right. Which root is motor? It's the ventral root. That means the anterior one. And which one is sensory? The dorsal root is always going to be sensory. And so roots only carry information one way, right? They're either going to be afferent or efferent. There's never a mixed signal in a spinal root. But the two roots come together to form a spinal nerve that moves through your body. So a nerve actually has both afferent and efferent signals in it. All right, so how are you going to remember which root is the motor root? Yeah, ventral, because there's a T in ventral and there's a T in motor. That will work for a couple weeks, at least for the test, right? And there's an S in dorsal and there's an S in sensory. So you can memorize that very easily. All right, what is a reflex? What's a reflex? Yep, it's something that protects your body from some kind of harmful stimulus. Does it require your conscious thought? Nope. It usually happens at the level of the spinal cord, and in the spinal cord, you don't think. You think with your cerebral cortex, right? So a reflex just happens very quickly and automatically to protect your body. And so you should know the parts of a reflex arc. So a reflex arc always starts with something, and it ends with something else. And these things that I'm talking about might not be in your book, in the figure, but I mentioned it in class. What does a reflex arc always start with? A stimulus. And what does it end with? A response. All right, so now let's talk about the other parts of a reflex arc. So you got a stimulus, number one. And in order for you to perceive that stimulus, you need a receptor for that. Right? If you don't have eyes, you can't be sensitive to light. Right? If you don't have ears, you can't hear anything. So you need receptors for that stimulus. All right? And then how does that that receptor send information to the brain? What kind of pathway? It's a sensory pathway. What's another name for sensory pathway? Afferent nerve, right? So a sensory nerve or an afferent nerve sends information into the spinal cord. And once it's in the spinal cord, it stimulates an interneuron or an association neuron. So that's another part. The association neuron analyzes the information and makes a decision on what to do, and it sends its decision out of the central nervous system into the periphery via a motor nerve. What's another name for motor nerve? Efferent nerve. So the efferent nerve, where's the efferent nerve going to go to? It's going to innervate something. It's going to innervate a muscle. That's a nice specific thing. Generally, what would we call a muscle? But it might also innervate a gland, for instance. It's what we call an effector. An effector would be a skeletal muscle. And the effector is going to produce the very last thing in a reflex arc, which is the response, right? So if I touch something hot, that hot is the stimulus. Temperature receptors in my finger sense it, goes up an afferent pathway to my spinal cord. Spinal cord says, you're burning your fingers. You better move your hand out of the way. Sends a signal out the efferent nerves to the effector, which is a muscle, causing it to contract, which is going to what? Move my hand away from that damaging stimulus. And that would be the response. So that's part of a reflex arc. Okay, what are the three layers of the meninges, starting from the most superficial to the deepest one? The dura, that's the tough, thick one. And then the next one is the arachnoid, and then the weakest one is the pia mater. Be able to list layers from superficial to deep, that's just what we did. Where is cerebral spinal fluid found within those layers? Yeah, it's underneath the arachnoid before you get to the pia, so it's between the arachnoid and the pia. And that space is called the subarachnoid space because it's underneath the arachnoid, subarachnoid space. Okay, number 20. What do somatic voluntary nerves innervate? Somatic voluntary. What is the only thing you have control of in your body? Skeletal muscle. And that's what somatic, so somatic and voluntary really mean the same thing. So that's like saying, what do voluntary nerves innervate? Okay, so don't forget that. What do autonomic nerves innervate? Three things. Cardiac muscle is one. Smooth muscle is another. And then glands. That's right. Cardiac, smooth muscle, and glands just take care of themselves because of the autonomic nervous system. Yeah, cardiac muscle, your heart, you can't control that. That takes care of itself all the time. Smooth muscle. So example of where you would have smooth muscle is your digestive tract. You don't ever think about, my stomach needs motion, and think about squishing your stomach. It just automatically takes care of itself because it has smooth muscle. And then the third place also are glands. Okay? Glands. Cardiac muscle, smooth muscle, and glands. That's where autonomic nerves go. How many cranial nerves are there? There are actually 12 pairs of them, and they're numbered 1 through 12. They also have names. And I think I showed you how to try to remember the names. If you ever take a class, you got to know all 12 and the names of all 12 and all that kind of stuff using that mnemonic. Did I put that in the notes or not? I didn't. Yeah, it's that German thing. Oh, I should actually make a photocopy, give it to you. You know, there's a good website. If you ever have to memorize a bunch of stuff in a chemistry class or anatomy or whatever, and it's called medicalmnemonics.com. If you ever need to research, the best thing is to make up your own mnemonic, but if you need to just look up one quick, it's called medicalmnemonics.com. It's kind of a funny little word, it's www and all that kind of stuff. And you can put all kinds, so you can search history, if you have to know all the names of the presidents of the United States or something, there's probably a little saying or something to help you remember all that kind of stuff, or different kinds of chemicals like the periodic table or whatever. And if you want to use them in here, that's fine, okay? Maybe you write it down on your Scantron or something. But on medicalmnemonics.com, they've got PG-rated and X-rated mnemonics and all that kind of stuff. So don't use any X-rated mnemonics in class. It's the only thing I ask, okay? All right. All right, so what do, how many, 12? Okay, know the name and function. Okay, so there are four cranial nerves. I want you to know the name and the function of the 12. All right, so number one. And don't forget, it's easy when you see a picture of cranial nerves because they're labeled number 1 through number 12 as you go from anterior to posterior. So it's really easy. All you have to do is make sure you know how to count to 12. That gets difficult after 10 sometimes. But I think as long as you don't freak out, it's easy to do. That's not one of your exam figures, but if you ever take an anatomy class, you'll probably have to do that. So where do you start numbering, from anterior or posterior? From the anterior. So what's the most anterior thing on your face? That is your nose, right? And that just so happens, that's cranial nerve number 1. Where does it go to? Goes to your nose, right? And so what is that sense called in your nose? Olfaction. So that's the olfactory nerve. Cranial nerve number 1 is the olfactory nerve. What's another sense organ that's very anterior on your face? Your eye, right? Yeah. And so cranial nerve number 2 is the optic nerve, that's purely sensory, and number 3 is oculomotor nerve, and that it doesn't control all aspects of your eye motion, but a lot of aspects of it, right, that moves your eyeball around, so you can look at different things. And then we skip to number 10. What's cranial nerve number 10? That's the vagus nerve. And what's one important function of the vagus nerve? It slows your heart rate down. It decreases your heart rate. So that's pretty important. All right, number 21. What are the two divisions of the autonomic nervous system? I think we answered that already. But that's sympathetic and parasympathetic. Are the divisions synergistic or antagonistic to each other? They're antagonistic, right? So we said that cranial nerve number 10 slows the heart down. That's due to the parasympathetic nervous system. So what does the sympathetic nervous system do for the heart? It does the opposite, which means it speeds it up. Right. All right. Give an example of a primary neurotransmitter for each division. So don't forget, the divisions are parasympathetic and sympathetic. A neurotransmitter for parasympathetic is? For parasympathetic is actually acetylcholine. All right, so cranial nerve number 10 is parasympathetic. It releases acetylcholine on the heart, and it slows the heart down. The sympathetic neurotransmitter is going to be norepinephrine. So sympathetic nerves go to the heart and release norepinephrine on the heart, and guess what the effect of that is on the heart? Increases heart rate and also force of contraction. Okay. And norepinephrine and epinephrine come from the adrenal medulla gland. Like when you get scared to death and think you're going to die, your adrenal gland releases a lot of epinephrine and norepinephrine. What happens to your heart? Does it slow down or speed up? It speeds up, that's right. And it might speed up for a pretty long time. All right? Okay. And then the last question, which division is responsible for the flight or fight response? That's the sympathetic. All right, so the flight or fight response is when you perceive a stimulus which is basically life-threatening to you, whatever it might be. And so what are some of the effects of the sympathetic nervous system? What about heart rate? It goes up. Forces of contraction. You can probably feel your heart pounding inside your chest. Your pupil diameter. What do you think is going to happen to your pupil diameter with sympathetic stimulation? Are they going to get really small so it's harder to see, or are they going to dilate so that they're going to dilate so you can see what's going on around you? All right. What about blood flow to digestive organs? If you need to fly or fight somebody, do you need to be digesting a lot of food? You don't, right? So blood supply is going to be taken away from your digestive tract, all right? And where is that blood going to go to? It's going to go to muscle so that you can run away or fight or whatever you need to do to deal with that stimulus, all right? So those are some important things. Okay. So that's it for nervous systems. So don't forget, if you want to see your grades after class or you want to get some Scantrons back, see me after class. All right, well, let's see what we can do with... I think I might need... a handout. All right, so today's lecture, we're going to look at some senses. Most generally speaking, there are two kinds of senses in your body. There are general senses and special senses. And you know what? On the website, I have a PowerPoint tutorial, a video tutorial that talks about the difference between general and special senses. If you want to view it before the test, that might be helpful to do that. Maybe I'll show you how to get to it after class. All right, so the two kinds of senses we have are general and special. So I want you to know what the difference is. First, general senses. If we were to take an ice cube and put it on your ear, could you feel it?
Yeah.
What about your elbow? Could you feel it? And if we put it on your back, could you feel it? Or on your kneecap? Or on your big toe? No matter where you put that temperature sensation, you can appreciate it, right? So that's why we call that, right, temperature a general sense, is because you have that perception everywhere on your body. No matter where we put that ice cube, you can feel it. Right, the same thing for pain. If we took a tack and we poked you in the nose, you could feel it, right? Or on your chin or your elbow or your kneecap, you could feel that needle, no problem. So again, since you have that perception all over your body, that's a general sense. You have pain receptors all over your body. And what about touch? If somebody were to touch you on your shoulder or the back of your knee or your belly button or whatever, you could feel that. So that's a general sense. Same thing for pressure. These are all general sensations. But we have some sensations that are special. And olfaction is the sense of smell. Taste, sometimes we call that the gustatory sensation. That's a special sense. Vision is special. Hearing and also balance are special. Now, why do we call these special? Well, for instance, if we take some salt, okay, which is something you can taste, and we put some salt on your earlobe, can you taste it?
No.
Your belly button, can you taste it? No, right? So this is special because you only have one place in your body where you have receptors for that sensation, and that is your tongue, right? Same thing for vision. If we shine a light on your kneecap, can you see it? No, or the back of your hand. You can't, right? There are only two organs in your body. It's very special locations that are highly specialized that you can perceive light, and that's your eyes, right? So special senses, all right, you can sense special senses only from one or two very specialized places on your body that have specialized organs. So that's why we call these special senses. And what about hearing? Can you hear with your kneecap? No. Belly button? Can't, right? So that's another special sense. So we're going to look at these special senses in, I guess, probably right now after I talk a little bit more about these general senses. Okay. What about the general senses? Well, these sometimes are what we call cutaneous senses or somatic senses because they're on the surface of your body most of the time. All right, so we looked at the integument before. So here is the epidermis, here is the dermis. And you can see that there are some free nerve endings in here. Right, free nerve endings are responsible for temperature sensation as well as pain. There are Meissner's corpuscles, these little end organs right here that are responsible for touch. There are some that are deeper, okay, deeper down in the dermis. So in order for these to send information to the brain, it requires a stronger stimulus or a deformation, the deforming of your skin. We call that a Pacinian corpuscle. So that's important for deep pressure or deep vibration. Okay, so some sensors are just free nerve endings. Some are specialized nerve endings that we call Meissner's corpuscles or Pacinian corpuscles. And these are all what we call general senses because you have them all over your body. There's another kind of sense, which is the sense of position. That's a general sense. So again, what does a general sense mean? Where do you have receptors for general senses? All over your body. So there are receptors in all of your muscles, all your tendons, and all your joints that tell you what position your body's in. And for instance, if I were to, could I have your hand?
Sure.
Okay. Close your eyes a second. Okay. And I'm going to put your hand someplace. All right. And you can't see where your hand is, can you?
No.
But you know where your hand is?
Yeah.
Where's your hand?
Over my head.
It's over your head. And that's because you have proprioceptors all over your body. You know the angulation of joints. You know tension in muscles. We call that sense proprioception, the sense of body position. So proprioception sounds like it's a special sense, but is it special?
Nope.
Why isn't it special? Because you've got those receptors all over your body, right? So you could do that with your right hand or left hand or foot or whatever, and you would know where it is, right? So that's not a special sense. All right, let's talk about the sense of olfaction. The sense of olfaction, okay, which is the sense of smell. So there are airborne molecules called odors. And those molecules have to bind to receptors in nerves. So this is, let's take a look at this picture right here. So here we see a nice sagittal section of somebody's nose. All right, it's almost sagittal. It's a little off of midline. And here is the frontal lobe of your brain, and here's something underneath it called the olfactory bulb. And then emanating from the olfactory bulb are nerves that go through a bone that is right on the top roof of your nasal cavity. Right, I don't think you have to know the name of this bone right here. So here is the bone. It's got all these holes, and you can see the nerves going through it. And where do those nerves stick out? All right, in your nasal cavity. This is really strange. This is the only place in your body where you actually have nerves that are sticking out in space, just dangling in space. But an odorant molecule is going to come in your nasal cavity, all right? And where you smell from is way up in the top surface of your nasal cavity, not on the sidewalls or down on the bottom or anywhere. So if you really want to smell something, what do you have to do to smell it? You got to sniff it. Yeah, you got to breathe in. Okay, but not just breathe in gently, because if you breathe in gently, air is just going to come through here and then down into your lungs. So if you really want to appreciate an odorant molecule, you got to do what? You got to go, you got to really get it up over here where all these olfactory nerves are. Okay, we call that sniffing. So an odorant molecule is going to bind to these olfactory receptor cells, and that's going to cause an electrical signal in the cell. It's going to go up into the olfactory bulb, which then goes to the brain for your appreciation of whatever that odor is. And what cranial nerve is responsible for transmitting that information to your brain? Cranial nerve number one, and we call that the olfactory nerve. And there are about 7 primary odors. You don't have to know what any of those are, but you can smell more than 7 different things because, right, if something stimulates receptor number 1 and 2, that gives you a sense of whatever the combination of those 2 primary odors is. Right? And maybe it's going to be a combination of number 2 and 4 and 5. That's going to give you a perception of another kind of odor. And your brain can figure all of that out. All right, so that is olfaction. In order for you to perceive something, don't forget that that odorant molecule has to bind to those olfactory receptor cells. All right, taste. Taste is what we call the gustatory sense. There are taste buds on our tongue, and a molecule has to bind to a receptor on a taste bud. So, for instance, here is a tongue right here. Okay, and if we look in on the surface of the tongue, you can see some bumps on it. Okay, that's what we call a papillae. That's really not a taste bud. The thing that you can see with your eye is not a taste bud. It's a papillae. And lining a papillae are specialized cells and specialized little organs that we have right here. So this is a taste bud. So in order to see a taste bud, you would need a microscope to see these cells. All right, so here is a receptor cell, a taste cell, and on the tip of that cell are some projections like little cilia. All right, so they call it a taste hair, but it's really like a cilium that has receptors on it. And when a certain kind of molecule binds to that cilium right there, that can start an electrical signal that goes to the brain for your appreciation of taste. And taste has four primary sensations. Do I give them to you? Yeah. Okay, they're sour, salty, sweet, and bitter. So bitter and sour are more on the back of the tongue. Sweet is more on the tip of the tongue. And maybe you could try this at home. Maybe get some sugar and dissolve it in some water and put a little drop of sugar water way in the back of your tongue and see if you can taste it. And I guess you can't. My guess is that you can't do it because the receptors are going to be for sweet on the tip of the tongue. And then get some lemon or something. Okay, and what is lemon? Lemon could be a little bitter and a little sour combined together. And put some lemon on the tip of your tongue. And guess what? I bet you can't perceive it. You can't taste it. You won't be able to taste it until you get to what? The posterior part of your tongue over here. So tastes are arranged by location on the surface of the tongue. Right? And here are the four kinds of tastes. And somebody's come up with another kind of taste, sensation. Does anybody know what a fifth kind of sensation is? So there's a lot of debate what the actual sensations are. Okay, yeah. Umami. Okay, which means deliciousness. All right, so that's a sense. And there's a chemical that stimulates this kind of taste bud right here. Did I mispronounce that really badly? Does anybody know? Deliciousness? No, that one I pronounced okay. I'm talking about umami. Okay. Somebody should tell me how to pronounce that word correctly if I'm not doing that. But the chemical that stimulates this receptor right here is, for instance, like monosodium glutamate. Some people are shaking their head like, oh my God, there's no hope. Okay. But like monosodium glutamate stimulates this receptor, and that's why it can be used as a flavor enhancer. All right. So that's the taste sensation. So again, there has to be a molecule that binds to those cells. All right. The next kind of sense is vision. Now, is vision a special sense or a general sense? It's special sense because you can only perceive light with your eyes and no other location on your body. All right, so let me put some of the ear slides away and get some of the eyeball slides out. All right, so the structures necessary for vision sometimes actually have something to do with light, the perception of light, and then there are other structures that just actually help protect your eye and help the eye function. So for instance, what part of your eye is not important for vision, but it protects your eye? The eyelids. Do I got that in there? Eyelids right here. Eyebrows also, right? That little strip of hair that's superior to your orbits. Right there, that helps prevent things falling down from your head down into your eyes. Right? Eyelids, what else is associated with your eyelids, which I don't have on this list? That should be eyelashes, right? Again, so eyebrows and eyelashes also have sensory endings on them, so if something brushes up against them, what are you going to do? You're going to blink, right? And so that's going to help protect your eyes. So eyebrows and eyelashes help protect your eyes because they cause you to blink. Right, conjunctiva. That's a membrane on the inner surface of your eyelids. Does anybody know what that really funny word is for an eyelid? There's an anatomical name for an eyelid. Palpebra. 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 You ever run into that sometime? That's not on your test, but anyway, you might run into that sometime. Eyelid is a palpebra. All right. Conjunctiva is a membrane on the inner surface of an eyelid. And it's usually moistened and it's kind of slippery because there's a gland that secretes tears onto the surface of the eye and it just lubricates the eyelid. It washes out foreign bodies that are in your eye and it prevents your eyes from drying out. And It probably even has some agents that suppress infections that can start to grow on the surface of your eye. That comes from a lacrimal gland. So lacrimal glands really don't help you see light per se, but it helps in the function of the normal eyeball. All right, and then there are some muscles that attach to the eyeball itself, and we call those extrinsic eye muscles. We say extrinsic because they're on the outside of the eye, and guess what they do? They move the eyeball around. So even if you don't turn your head, you can still look in different directions just by using those extrinsic eye muscles, and there's six of them. All right, I'll show you where these are right now. All right, so here's a picture of an eye, and this is kind of like a sagittal section through the eye. So here we have an eyelid, and we can see some eyebrows and some eyelashes right here. This inner surface is what we call the conjunctiva of an eyelid. Okay, and I think that shows what I wanted to show pretty much, pretty well there. All right, what about the extrinsic eye muscles? Oh, here's a nice drawing of an eyeball. All right, sometimes we call that a globe, or sometimes we call that just a globe of the eye. So these red things are skeletal muscle. It's voluntary muscle, so you can control the position of your eye. There's six of them. These straight ones are what we call a rectus muscle. So this is underneath the eye. That's the inferior rectus. Here's one on top of the eye. Here's the superior rectus. And then lateral rectus, and there's going to be a medial. And then there's some that curve around, like this one right here. There's an inferior oblique and a superior oblique. This is not an exam figure, but I think it's pretty easy to see how you name these different muscles that help position your eye when you're looking at stuff, when you're reading, for instance. All right? And so those things are what we call accessory structures. The last kind of accessory structure that we're going to look at right here has to do with that gland that secretes tears. So superior and lateral to the eye, about in this location right here, is the lacrimal gland. So here's the lacrimal gland. It secretes tears through these lacrimal ducts into the superior part and lateral part of the eyelid, and tears then flow over the eye, washing away debris. And then in the corner of your eye, the medial corner of your eye, there's something called a caruncle. You don't have to know what that little funny little wormy thing is right in here. And there are some holes in that caruncle. And so that's just what we call the superior and inferior canaliculi, which take tears into a little duct, right, which we call the nasolacrimal duct, that empties into your nasal cavity. So it goes from your eye into your nasal cavity. And in most circumstances, when you don't produce a lot of tears, then okay, they end up in your nose and you just kind of swallow them down. But under certain circumstances, maybe you might be producing a lot of tears. Like when? Like when you're crying, for instance, and you can't probably swallow fast enough to get them all out of your nose. You get some sniffles. And okay, that's why you get a runny nose when you cry, because your tears are supposed to end up in your nose. All right, so because you don't have tears really running out of your eyes all the time. All right, so it gets down through this nasal lacrimal duct into your nasal cavity. All right, so those are all accessory structures for vision. All right, so now let's turn our attention to vision per se, some of the structures that are necessary for vision, all right, in the eye. And maybe the best thing to do is to actually just look at a nice picture of the eye and figure out where all these different things are. All right, so this right here is what? That probably is an exam figure. That's my guess. Okay, so you got to know how to label this thing. So this is your eye. All right, so you've got what? You got some eyelids here and here. And let's start with the most anterior part of the eye, which is right here. This is how light first enters the eye. It's a transparent tissue called the cornea. So here is the cornea. And let's talk about some other layers. The cornea is continuous with a part of the eye which is white. Looks very, very white. And that white part of the eye is what we call the sclera. So you don't see it in the back, but you see the white part of the eye up over here in the anterior part. The job of the sclera is to protect the eye and to give the eyeball its shape. The sclera is even tougher than your skin. It has a lot of collagen in it. It's really difficult to damage, so it protects the eyeball. The next deeper layer, right here, is called the choroid. And the choroid contains blood vessels, so it can nourish the sclera, but it can also then nourish the deepest layer of the eye, which is the retina. So here is the retina right here. And the retina contains the photoreceptor cells that allows you to perceive light. Right? And usually you don't have blood vessels in the retina, but the retina is very close to a layer that does have blood vessels. What layer has blood vessels again? That's the choroid. Right, so here's the choroid. Because if you had blood vessels in the retina, you would have photoreceptor cells, and then you would have a blind spot right there. So you don't have blood vessels in the retina. Okay. You also see this little indentation right here. This is what we call the fovea centralis. This is the part of the eye that has the best vision. And right around the fovea centralis, there's another little part, which you don't have to know for the test, but I'll just tell you. Just surrounding the fovea centralis, sometimes we call that area, which has the next best vision, the macula lutea. Macula lutea. And maybe you've kind of heard that term before. Has anybody ever come into that, heard that term before, macula? All right, there's some people that lose their vision because cells in this area of the retina have a tendency to degenerate. It's called macular degeneration. Anybody hear of macular degeneration? Okay. All right, well, if you haven't heard of it, I'm glad. Because if you have heard of it, maybe you know somebody that has macular degeneration, and it affects their very central vision, and they just have a spot right in the very center of their vision. That's probably the most obnoxious place to lose your vision. Because when you look at something, the extrinsic eye muscles place what you're looking at right in the center of your vision. And that's where you can't see when you have macular degeneration. All right, so these are the three layers, starting from superficial to deep. The sclera, which is tough. The choroid, which is vascular, has blood vessels. And then the retina, which contains photoreceptor cells for vision. Now, there is one place on the retina that doesn't have photoreceptor cells. And that's where the optic nerve attaches to the retina. And we call that the optic disc, or another way of saying optic disc, sometimes we call that the blind spot. Right here. And has anybody ever seen their blind spot? No? I could, after class, if you want to find it, I can show you how to find it. We can do a little exercise on the board. I can put a little mark on the board, and when you look, I can put my finger on the spot and you won't even be able to see my fingertip, because we all have a blind spot in each eye. But our brain is so powerful in synthesizing reality that it gets information from one eye and it fills in one blind spot, and it gets information from your other eye and it fills in the other blind spot. So you don't have any idea where this blind spot is, but I can show you how to find it if you're interested after class. Okay? And what is that blind spot? It's really called the optic disc, because that's where the optic nerve attaches to the retina, so you have no photoreceptor cells right there. All right, well, there are some other structures associated with the eye, and that is the lens right here. So here is the lens, and the lens can change shape. It can get real thick or it can get real thin, depending on whether a muscle is going to be pulling on it, and that muscle is called the ciliary body right here. The ciliary body is connected to the lens via these suspensory ligaments, so the shape of the lens changes, and that's important because for the following reason. Okay, when we look at something, we can't focus on everything at the same time. So for instance, if you put your hand out in front of your face like that and look at your fingernail, so focus on your fingernail, what can you tell me about everything behind your finger? Like the rest of the room. Is it in focus or out of focus? It's out of focus. So now when you focus on the room and not your fingertip, what happens to your fingertip? I see like two of them, but it's terribly out of focus, all right? So that process of focusing at a certain depth, you can't focus on all depths simultaneously, is what we call accommodation. So what's changing is the shape of the lens depending on what length or what distance away from your face you're trying to focus on an object at. All right, and so it's the job of the ciliary body to change the shape of the lens that allows you to focus either far away or close up. So that's what the lens is really important for. Not for just plain old focusing, but for changing the depth at which you're focusing at, or the distance at what you're focusing at. And that's one of the unfortunate things that happens as we get older, is that, guess what, does that lens get more fluid or does it get stiffer as we get older? It gets stiffer, like many other things in our body. It gets stiffer as we get older, so it doesn't like to change shape. And it takes longer for it to change shape. And so I guess I could relate that to something that we have all experienced, right? And that is when we see somebody who's really old driving down the freeway, what speed are they driving? Like 10 miles an hour, right? And in a 65 mile an hour zone, all right? And it can be irritating, but I would like for you to perceive what their reality is really like, right? Because they have difficulty accommodating because that lens doesn't like to change shape. So what is, when there's somebody that's 70 years old, what are they really concerned about? Speeding. They don't want to get a speeding ticket because they get one ticket and then their license is yanked, right? So what are they looking at so they don't get a speeding ticket? They're looking at their dashboard, their speedometer, right? So they look at their speedometer and they see, oh, I'm only going 10 miles an hour. Great, I'm not going to get a speeding ticket, all right? So they're happy, but then they realize, oh my God, I'm on the freeway. It's the last place I want to be. I don't want to miss my exit. So then they look up from the dashboard, which is what, close to their eyes. They look down the road and look for an exit. And what do they see when they look up from the dashboard down the road to find their exit? It's all blurry. That's right, because it takes a while for this lens to change shape, right? So 1001, 1002, can't see what you're doing. And then all of a sudden everything pops into focus. And then the exit is way down the road and you go, ah, all right, I'm not going to miss my exit. But then, what are you worried about?
Going too fast.
Going too fast. So you're not looking down the road anymore. You change your gaze to the dashboard, and what do you see?
Blurry.
Nothing, right? Because it's all blurry. 1001, 1002, then it pops into focus. And you go, ah, all right, I'm not speeding. Don't want to lose my license. Now what are you going to be worried about?
Did
I miss my exit? So again, you look down the freeway, and what do you see? Nothing. It's all blurry because it takes a while for this lens to accommodate, to adjust for different depths of focus. All right. So that's what a person, when they're older, has to deal with. Right. So anyway, so if you run into a viejito out there, just give them a lot of distance. Right. And be kind to them because they just can't see. It takes them time. So just try to relax and stay away from them because they might not even see you before you get run over. Okay? Huh? Even with glasses, most glasses you can focus on one depth or one distance. Unless you wear fancy glasses that are bifocals or trifocals, and then you can change your head position pretty fast like that. Or progressives, like what I have, progressives. So depending on the distance, you know, I can change the angle of my head to see either close up or farther away. All right, but if it's just a regular pair of glasses, it only allows you to see at one distance. Yeah. Okay, so don't forget, accommodation is due to that lens changing shape. All right, so there's a lot of motion going on inside your eye besides these extrinsic eye muscles. Another thing that's changing all the time is the iris. So the iris is what gives color to your eye, right? Like some people have blue eyes or gray eyes or green eyes or brown eyes, all right? And black eyes, right? Very strong eyes, right? That iris, so the iris can constrict or can dilate, making the hole in the iris either bigger or smaller. That hole in the iris is what we call the pupil. That's how light enters the eye, through the pupil. The diameter of the pupil is controlled by the iris right here. What was I going to say about that? Oh, so the iris is changing all the time. It's moving. It's getting, the pupil is getting smaller or bigger depending on light conditions. So for instance, if it's very bright, like if I were to look into the projector of this light right here, then my pupil would get really, really small, protecting my retina from all that light that's coming out. But if it's dark, then this pupil is going to get really big, the iris is going to relax, and the pupil is going to be large, letting a lot of light in. Oh yeah, they got these really big eyes. As a matter of fact, there's a one nocturnal animal that has even a huge eyeball. It almost takes up their whole face, and it's just one big pupil. But they can see perfectly with almost no light at all. Okay, so then here is the cornea. Now notice the shape of this cornea right here. Is it flat or is it curved? It's curved. What about the shape of this lens right here? Is it flat or is it curved? It's curved. So the cornea acts like a lens as well. As a matter of fact, the most important thing for focusing light on the retina, just like when you have to focus a camera, is the shape of the cornea. That's the most important thing, that it gives you good sharp vision. The lens right here only allows for small adjustments, either close up or far away, but what really allows you to see sharply is the shape of the cornea. And there's sort of a relatively new surgical procedure. If someone is not interested in wearing glasses, their vision can be corrected using lasers by changing the shape of the cornea. Right, so if they change the shape of the cornea, people can end up with perfect vision, at least for that one point in time after they get the surgery, and that's called a LASIK procedure. Anybody ever hear of the LASIK procedure? And maybe some of you have gotten it in here. Okay, so the LASIK procedure is pretty ingenious because you don't have to dig around at anything that's deep inside the eye. You can just adjust something that's on the surface of the eye, change the shape of the cornea, and you don't even need glasses. In just like half a second, you'll have perfect vision. I don't recommend that, personally, for cosmetic reasons. A lot of people do it for cosmetic reasons. They don't like to wear glasses, right? Because that correction is only good for that one point in your life, that one time. And what happens to your vision over your lifetime? It changes. And as a matter of fact, in a lot of people, it even gets better as you get older because the shape of your eyeball changes. Usually it gets worse, but some people it even gets better. So that LASIK procedure will only work for that one point in your life, right? And then you might have to wear glasses. Okay. Something else too about LASIK procedure is that it's not always done perfectly. Somebody can make a mistake, and if somebody's blasting a laser in your eye, I don't know, I'm kind of squeamish about doing that, but there usually aren't too many complications, but there can be some complications for that. And then the other thing is, as you get older, right? Well, what do you know, any, like your grandma and grandpa, if they want to read something, what do they need to read something with? They need reading glasses, right? So, as a matter of fact, if you put on regular glasses for you to see far away, and you try to read something up close, it's impossible when you get older. So you need to take off your far away glasses and put on your reading glasses, yeah? And then if you keep your far away glasses on, you even need more correction to read something. So what happens is, I've known a lot of people to get a LASIK procedure so that they can see things far away beautifully and clear, have even better than normal vision, but they lose their near vision. And that really is a surprise to them. They'll be walking out of the doctor's office and get a phone call and get their cell phone out of their pocket, and then they can't even see their cell phone. They can't even dial a number because they've lost their near vision. So LASIK is good, it will give you great far vision, but at the expense of what? You lose your near vision to where now you have to wear reading glasses immediately, like overnight. So there are a lot of trade-offs, so if you're going to get that kind of procedure, just talk to a doctor that can tell you about all that kind of stuff. Alright, so the lens has to change shape, the iris has to change shape, and the other thing about what I don't like about LASIK procedure is that you don't have to wear glasses anymore. Right, so you go, well, why is that such a bad thing? Well, we talked about the sclera being really, really tough, right? It's very hard to damage, but the cornea, on the other hand, since it's clear, is very easy to damage. All right, so if you don't wear glasses, then you can damage the cornea very easily by getting some kind of foreign object in there. And there are a lot of nerve endings in the cornea. And if the cornea is ever damaged, supposedly that's the most exquisite sense of pain that you can ever experience. So I don't know if anybody's ever damaged a cornea. It used to be when people got contact lenses, they were hard contact lenses. They were called gas impermeable. And the only way, and the cornea is alive, and where the cornea would get oxygen is just from the air. But if you have this big plastic cap over the cornea, then that slowly kills the cornea. So if you had those kinds of contact lenses from way back when, you always had to take them out at night. If you fell asleep with contact lenses in, it would damage the cornea, and you would wake up in the morning as if somebody was taking a red-hot poker and sticking it in your eyes. Okay, terrible sensation. And as a matter of fact, even worse because what those nerve endings just operate so well. As a matter of fact, the pain is so bad, you would never ever think of going to sleep again with your contact lenses in, no matter what kind of condition you were in. And I've only known one person, actually, my whole life that actually did it twice. Not successive nights, but actually did it at different times in her life, right? Because the pain is so bad, you'd never forget to take your contact lenses out again. All right, so that's an important reason. But here's another important reason. There are some spaces deep inside the eye. The space that is anterior to the lens right here is what we call the anterior cavity. So here is the anterior cavity. Everything in front of the cornea, in front of the lens, everything posterior to the lens is what we call the posterior cavity. And these cavities have different kinds of fluids in them. The posterior cavity has a fluid called vitreous humor. It's like jello. It doesn't like to flow around. It's very viscous, and it helps give the eyeball its shape. But in this anterior cavity right here, it's not vitreous humor. It is filled with aqueous humor. What does aqueous mean? It means watery. What can water do? Like if I put a drop of water on my hand and turn my hand like that, what would happen to the water? It would just run right off my hand, right? So the same thing can happen to this anterior cavity right here. If the cornea is damaged, that aqueous humor will run right out of the eye. And it will roll down your cheek, right? But here's the really bad thing. So it's going to hurt like hell. It's going to hurt really, really bad. But here's the thing. When the aqueous humor leaves this anterior cavity, the iris can touch the lens. And the cornea can touch the iris. And no one has ever figured out a way to unstick these structures because they're sticky. All right, so when that aqueous humor runs out of this anterior cavity, the iris gets stuck to the lens and the cornea gets stuck to the lens and the iris right here, and that's forever. But what can you tell me about the iris and the lens in the normal individual? Is it just something that's static in your eye, or is it something that's always moving around and adjusting for light conditions and for what you're looking at? It's always adjusting itself, but what happens when it gets stuck together? It can't move, right? So when that aqueous humor runs out of somebody's eye, their vision is completely screwed up for the rest of their lives. And that's because that cornea is what? Very delicate structure. So that's another reason why I don't like the LASIK procedure so much, is because it's a good thing, I think, to wear glasses all the time, especially if you're a guy that likes to build engines or ride motorcycles or play sports or whatever, right? Or even build a swing set for your kids in the backyard. Things can fly into your eye and damage that cornea, and you could lose vision in that one eye. All right, so that's some things about the eye. The last thing, so make sure you can label this diagram. The last thing is that in the retina, there are two kinds of cells. There are rod cells and cone cells. The rod cells work in dim light. Okay, so they work, well, if I were to turn all the lights off in here, we could still see things, but what we would see is more in black and white. We couldn't see color in dim light. So in order for us to see color, we need a different kind of cell, photoreceptor cell. We call those cones. All right, so they can see color, but the trade-off here is that these cells only operate in bright light. In order for you to see color, you need bright light. So in moonlight, which is very, very dim, can you see colors? Mostly black and white, shades of gray. But in nice bright light, almost like what we have in this room, right, you can see colors. Or in sunlight, where it's bright, nice colors, no problem. All right, so that's the eye. And that's some electricity. So that's the important things about the eye. So you do have to know something about those rod cells and cone cells, know what they're good for. And a rod cell is rod-shaped, and a cone cell is cone-shaped. Right. Okay. All right. So our last sense is hearing. Is hearing special or general?
Special.
It's special because you can only hear two places in your body, right? Your ears. All right. So let's look over the exam figure for hearing. All right. So here's the exam figure for hearing. And there are basically three parts to an ear. There is an external ear, there's a middle ear, and an internal part of the ear. And we can see them all here. The external ear is made up of, well, usually what we consider the ear. This is the auricle. Sometimes we call it the pinna of the ear. It helps focus sound energy into this part right here, which is the, this is still external ear, into the temporal bone. All right, and then it bumps into a little membrane. This is what we call the eardrum or tympanic membrane. This separates the external ear from the middle ear. And inside the middle ear, you have three little bones. So when the tympanic membrane vibrates back and forth, it presses on these bones right here and it vibrates the bones back and forth. And that transmits the sound energy into the inner part of the ear. So here is the inner part. The inner part starts right at what we call the oval window. So external ear includes the auricle and the external auditory meatus. That's a hole in the temporal bone until you get to the tympanic membrane. And then from the tympanic membrane to the oval window, this is what we call the middle ear. And you have three bones that we call the auditory ossicles. They're really tiny bones. And I could have them between my fingertips right here, and you couldn't see them. So we can pretend that I have them right here. That's how small they are. They fit inside your middle ear. They transmit what? Sound vibrations from the outer ear to the inner ear right here. Also connected to the middle ear is the auditory tube or eustachian tube. This is important sometimes. It's called the eustachian tube. It connects your throat to your middle ear. Because have any of you ever been up in an airplane or something and all of a sudden you can't hear and you have some pressure inside your ear? All right, and that's because, all right, the pressure on either side of the tympanic membrane should be the same. But as you go up in an airplane, the pressure in the plane decreases, but this one right here might stay at maybe wherever you were. Like if it was LAX, it would be, what, sea level. So you have higher pressure here, it's going to push on the tympanic membrane and it's going to be actually pretty painful. So how can you equalize the pressure on either side of the tympanic membrane? You could do something with your jaw, maybe you could chew gum, right? Or do something with your throat to open up this auditory tube to equalize the pressure. Or maybe you could even hold your nose and like blow into your nose. That's going to force some air up into this area right here, equalizing the pressure between them. Unless you have a cold or flu or something, sore throat, that completely blocks this tube right here, and then you're just going to be miserable the whole time on that airplane. And that's what happens to little kids. Because what do little kids usually, what do they have a tendency to get? Ear infections, right? And when they have an ear infection, that's really like terrible to do is to take them on an airplane because they can't equalize that pressure. And you can't tell a little kid to do a different kind of maneuver or chew gum or whatever if it's just a little baby, right? So they let you know because they start crying right at takeoff or when you start going back down, landing, either one of those conditions. So here are the auditory ossicles. There are three of them. There's something that looks like a stirrup. We call that the stapes. One in the middle is the incus, and then the malleus is the one that's attached to the tympanic membrane. The malleus attaches to the tympanic membrane, and the stapes attaches to the oval window right here. Okay, so now let's look at some parts of the inner ear. We see something that kind of looks like a snail right here. That's what we call the cochlea. And the cochlea gives us a sense of hearing. That's responsible for hearing. And then there are two other places. We have these semicircular canals. This gives us a sense of equilibrium, especially rotation. It's related to these semicircular canals. Right. Okay. And you know what? We're not done with senses. I've got probably another 10 minutes to do. Not very much, but 10 minutes. So I got to figure out what to do about the test coming up. I hate to postpone it one more time, but I think we're going to have to do that because we need to go over the questions again. So that means that you have a test on
Monday.
It's going to be Tuesday. Yeah, Tuesday. I always say Monday. It's going to be Tuesday the 28th. All right, now, if you want to see how to get to the website that has the general versus special senses, yeah, I'll show you how to do that. I'll have to boot up over here.
Your webpage?
It's my webpage, yeah. And it's just general v. special. All right, I'll take it.
Thanks.
All right, got your name on there? Oh, yeah, thanks, Ryan.